All right, so I'm lucky enough today to be here with Jeff Scott, spending some time in Fort Lauderdale, and we're going to talk about one of the articles that is accepted in print to be published soon on transcranial Doppler and its uses in the ED. So thanks for being here, Jeff.
Oh, very cool, and thanks for having me. Glad to have you down here in Florida with us in this nice weather going on.
Better than the one in Montreal. Yep.
For now. Look forward to coming to Montreal in May, for sure.
Awesome, awesome. Yes, Jeff, fortunately, is coming to H&R, and looking forward to having him there, and probably going to have him speaking sometime in the next couple of editions of the H&R. So, can you tell me a little bit about this article you guys have put out, or putting out?
Yeah, so in the MICU, we use TCD quite a bit. To help prognosticate and also with respect to trying to look at some abnormalities on the patients. And so myself and one of my residents thought we'd apply this to the ED, and when we have patients who come in really comatose, to get an idea pre-imaging or even post-imaging to follow them, because we can't just send them back to CAT scan. And so what we did in this article is we described basically a couple of interesting points to look at in the ED, such as midline shift, if a patient had a subarachnoid hemorrhage, vasospasm, looking at our post-strokes that sit in the ED before they go up to the neuro-ICU. So those things are well-defined in the article from a ED acute care perspective.
That's fantastic. So I'm a super basic TCD user. I learned from one awesome TCD guy, Rob Chen. But basically, I've been using it as a really gross screen sometimes when I've got some sick people with decreased level of consciousness, sometimes up on the wards and things, to one, spot something that looks really funny and weird and as a prompt to do a quick CT, or in some of the patients in the ICU who are not waking up, to look for, you know, the presence or absence of diastolic flow as a screen for a terribly high ICP, usually correlated with myoptic nerve sheaths and things like that, and distal carotid flow with maybe reverberant, reverberant flow, bidirectional and no diastolic flow. That's kind of been the only thing that I've touched at. And anything else, especially in terms of velocities and things like that, I said, I'll leave that to the people in neurocritical care units. But if you're bringing this to the ED, then maybe there's more to it. So you mentioned in the article about the use in, you know, large vessel occlusion and stroke, and that management's changed a lot recently since we're moving towards interventional treatment of such lesions. So can you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. So if you look at, for example, the temporal window, and you talk about the MCA, so primarily we're looking at the M1 segment and the M2 segment. And just to make sense out of that, if you go back to the best drawings from Netter and the Circle of Willis, and our article has a nice illustration that was done. So obviously the M1 is further away from you than is the M2, which is coming out closer to the cortex and the skull. And so by known distances that are pretty much referenced, and there's a reference chart as well that we put in there that's just taken from the standard literature, you can easily separate out M1 and M2 and look for sites of stenosis or occlusion. And so you can look at the velocities, you can look at some of the ratios that are published out there, the pulsatility index, and this has to do with basically your systolic upstroke and your diastolic slowly descending waveform. The CNS vessels, as opposed to the peripheral vessels, you know, are basically a lower resistance, and so you see this interesting diastolic slow decline. And basically, one of the things as well you can look at is hyperemia versus high velocities, for example, in vasospasm. By looking at the external carotid to the internal carotid in a ratio that's called the Lindegaard ratio. Now that would apply more there as opposed to a ischemic stroke.
Okay. That's definitely, I'll have to go back to Netter to refresh that Circle of Willis and identify those vessels. So sometimes I don't find transcranial Doppler particularly easy, especially in not, you know, in different patients. Sometimes you've got a very small person, presumably with fairly thin skull bones, and sometimes I just can barely get an image. So I'm looking forward to, I have a new ultrasound machine coming into the unit that's probably got more juice than the last one. So I'm looking forward to playing with that a little bit. But what's your personal experience in terms of how often do you get these nice images as opposed to just barely being able to make something out in there?
So I thought about that from the cardiac perspective. I think this is very similar to that, although you have more windows to play with cardiac-wise, where there's just those folks that you cannot get an apical for, you know, in an acute care setting, or you can't get a subcostal, but you can always find something most of the time. Here we're really using the temporal window most of the time because it's the most accessible in most people, probably 80-85%. And you know, it's beneficial to look at both sides, but you actually can insonate from the right and look at the left-sided vessels, mm-hmm. the ACA, the opposite M1. But that requires more skill, more time, more challenge, and a little bit of changes in some angle of insonation. It's just, as you can imagine, a further distance away. And that's how you know what you're actually looking at. The other windows are definitely more challenging, require much more practice and skill. The subcostal window, the suboccipital window. But the suboccipital window is where you want to go to look at the basilar artery. So if you have your posterior stroke type symptoms and you want to look at the vert, or maybe you want to look at the basilar, that would be the second window that I would work on trying to obtain. As far as the ophthalmic, we really don't use that, and it's a very different wave morphology because that is similar to that of a peripheral vessel. And so that's a much different resistance. And as far as also looking under the jaw, sort of in that region, that could be rather challenging too. But I think it's one of those things you have to just work with and see what you can acquire. But when you can't acquire it, you can't acquire it.
Okay. All right. Since I've got a eMERGE critical care doc here with me who has a strong neurosurgical base, I'm going to ask a little question here about what do you feel about the uncoupling of the circulation between large vessel and tissue perfusion at the level of the brain in terms of, and I'm going to set the stage of that question being, if I'm looking at a Schottky patient and, you know, there's some evidence maybe of edema on the scan, but I've got decent transcranial systolic and diastolic flow, does that reassure me at all? I mean, obviously when we've got a transcranial that shows a systolic spike but no diastolic flow, we're in big trouble. That's kind of telling us that your intracerebral pressure is right around your diastolic pressure, which is obviously really bad. But I can imagine that at the level of the feeding capillaries, it's just completely obliterated at that point. There's minimal, you know, if any, perfusion at all. Any comments on that?
Well, so to get into that area, I will say that I'm not aware of anything TCD-wise mm-hmm. that brings you to that level. It's definitely of a much more global measurement. I remember back in the day when I started out, we were doing jugular bulb,
yes.
You know, studies. And, you know, that was kind of, that went away and was kind of poo-pooed probably in the mid to late 2000s because it was felt to be, you know, more... Not really anything more than an isolated to an area and really couldn't be a global measurement, I think is how that was essentially looked at. So it's hard to comment on that
okay.
area, I think, for me these days.
All right. Now, in terms of the large vessel occlusion stroke, how would you use that in your decisional algorithm? Because I think you'd mentioned that sometimes you can see that you've failed recanalization, for instance, with TPA. So you can see that maybe in some peripheral hospitals that, you know, time is the matter. They're not able to get to a center. They give TPA, but how do you use that to say, well, look, we failed TPA. Now we really have to get to somewhere else or a second dose? Or what do you do with that?
Right. So here in the U.S., we have primary and comprehensive stroke centers. Primary is TPA and comprehensive is intervention. And so at that point, that would clue us into the fact this person should at least be looked at interventionally. If we see that post-stenotic issue that we're concerned about with respect to velocity changes. And so, yes, at that point, we would contact the neurologist and discuss transferring the patient to a higher level of care. Or if you're at a higher level of care, such as our tertiary hospital, then we would take them to the interventional suite quite often based on those changes if the neurointensivist, neurostroke doctor is in agreement with that.
So do you routinely do transcranial, or would you consider doing routinely transcranial to all your stroke patients that come in as a baseline?
Since it's a point of care, and if you're looking at the MCA-ACA, which is really the easier targets and probably the great majority of thrombotic and embolic stroke, then yeah, this is something, if you have the skill set, it's certainly worth looking at to see how they're progressing. No different than taking a look at a lung window for B-lines and seeing if they're going away with your ultrafiltration or your diuresis.
That's awesome. That's awesome, because I think, you know, there might be some people listening to this who are saying, oh my God, you know, transcranial Doppler, that's such a high level ultrasound thing that I wouldn't do it. And there's probably some people who think that TE is beyond, you know, their bedside ultrasound capabilities, but it's not. It's just a matter of sort of climbing up the ladder and just getting used to spending some time, you know, getting through your learning curve and getting your quote-unquote 10,000 hours in there to be comfortable with it. And admittedly, transcranial and things like we've been talking about, Doppler of the venous system, takes a little bit more time to get your muscle memory and your abilities up to speed, but you get there. And so as long as you see the need and the interest for this, I think these are all really useful skills, and that anyone who's in the POCUS world should really be looking at adding something to their game every year.
I agree, and that was kind of my five-year plan when I started taking on ultrasound, to start with heart and lung, and expand into the areas that, you know, you guys are putting out there, looking at hepatic vein and looking at portal vein and, you know, these things that I'm highly interested in now, and TCD comes along with that. Currently, my passion's TE, but, you know, everything is just a little piece to keep adding on, for sure.
All right. Well, thanks for taking the time today.
Thank you very much for having me, and welcome to Florida.
Thanks.